A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 166. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about Ghostwatch. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
Ghostwatch was a 1992 90-minute BBC television broadcast, and it showed us a live investigation of Britain's most haunted house, searching for ghosts and working to show evidence of ghosts in this haunted house.
And it has a reputation as one of the scariest things ever seen on British television, a lasting legacy and reputation, which we are going to talk about in some detail, and that has resulted in this show never being repeated on British television. And if you're listening to this not too long after our release, this will be quite suitable for our sort of Halloween shows, Brian. We're getting into a rather spooky Halloween type feel here.
Yes, we're finally matching things up to that time of year properly. It is something, as you say, that has a legacy and is well known for what it did at the time in 1992. So getting into the setup for this, Michael Parkinson was leading this investigation into ghosts in this apparently real haunted house. And he was a noted, very well-known television presenter or host and sort of celebrity interviewer. And they were trying to answer the question, once and for all, do ghosts exist? Can we find one, you know, through scientific means and show actual evidence?
And to do so, we've got this studio presentation with Michael Parkinson in the studio, surrounded by some experts, which we'll talk about as we go along. But also he's got the banks of people answering the phones from viewers, phoning in with their own ghost stories. And then this is tied in, they're linked to an outside broadcast unit, which is actually at this haunted house, with the team on the ground, as it were, reporting any developments as the night goes on.
Yes, absolutely. So this is a pretty elaborate thing that we have here with this broadcast. And of course, slowly the story of this house and the past of this house and what's going on, it slowly emerges, and we slowly get to hear more and more and see more and more about what's there. So of course we should mention the presenters and the hosts of this, the people who were in it, some very well-known names and some people who were certainly a big deal at the time. We already mentioned Michael Parkinson, and he has a long history on British television as a presenter and an interviewer. He's almost like someone like David Letterman or Jay Leno, as you have in the US. He's almost like the British equivalent of that.
Yeah, that's right. A big name to lead this show. Very familiar on British television. As we say, not quite sure how familiar some of these television names are across the pond, but for British TV, Michael Parkinson, one of the biggest names. And then he was joined by Sarah Green. She was leading the outside broadcast unit, so she's actually in the house reporting on the strange events as they go on. And Sarah Green, at the time, best known for being a presenter on the long-running children's programme Blue Peter, but also on shows like Saturday Superstore and Going Live. And again, at the time of the broadcast in 1992, she was almost one of the nation's sweethearts. She was an older sister to young viewers everywhere. So again, a very well-known name.
Certainly anyone who was a Blue Peter presenter for any period of time would be someone well known and recognizable, certainly with children or people who were children at the time of the Blue Peter days for that person. So it's certainly a big deal to have someone like that involved.
Absolutely. And back in the studio, we had Sarah Green's husband, Mike Smith. Again, somebody from Breakfast Television, a well-known radio presenter. And as a couple, they were very well-known on television. And Mike Smith was sort of manning the phone. So he's the chap walking round behind the banks of people answering the phones. And he's trying to summarise the calls and read out various important bits of information that come in as the night goes on.
And then, surprisingly, you have Craig Charles, who is probably best known now, I would think, because he was Blister in Red Dwarf for so many years. Certainly to our audience, he would be best known for that, I think. But he was also someone who had done a lot of comedy, and he was very well known. This was in the middle of Red Dwarf's original run. So he was definitely recognizable and someone who would sort of add a bit of variety and, you know, improvised humor and that sort of thing into a show like this. And he is there as like a roving reporter almost outside the house, getting crowd reactions, talking to different people, adding some sort of banter and, you know, roguish humor and what have you into things. And that's sort of the way you might expect in this sort of big event broadcast.
Yes, and it is Craig Charles very much in his cheeky chappy persona, giving us a bit of comic relief. So he would pop up wearing a scary mask and say boo and things like that and try to jolly things along at the start of the program when not so much seems to be happening. He, again, very well known from Red Dwarf at the time, so another very familiar face for British TV.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was before his EastEnders days, so he was much more a comedy and humor person at the time. So we should talk about the house itself. It was a North London semi-detached house that we see a lot of. It is the home of Pamela Early and her two young daughters, Suzanne and Kim. And there have been strange noises happening in this house that we're hearing about, and we've heard that there are lots of sort of strange and elusive things that have been happening there.
That's right. And some of these strange things have been happening to the oldest daughter, Suzanne, who is, she's an early teenager. There's been some odd behavior. She's had some unusual scratch marks that have been appearing on her face, and there's some photographic evidence of this. And as we say, we've got Sarah Green in the house with a mobile camera and sound crew who are running around behind her as they investigate various bits and pieces. And of course, for any sort of modern scientific attempt at ghost hunting, we are shown that the house has been equipped with a full range of... So we have motion sensors, we have thermometers, we have an infrared thermographic camera that can pick things up in the dark. And all this information is being put together to try and give us an idea of what's going on in the house.
Yes, absolutely.
Lights, telephone... right along at the far end of the spectrum to actual full-blown visual apparitions.
Now, we've got our own BBC scanner here, but what are you using it for exactly?
Well, we've got a remote video camera mounted in every room. We have our image analysis equipment linked in. The tape is time-coded, and atmospheric condition and temperature are logged on screen by sensors. Those are like the little burglar alarms.
So now we get to, I don't know if it's our spoiler warning section, but our point to get into a little bit of what was going on here. And as you may have been thinking and may have gathered by the fact that we are covering this, Ghost Watch was not a real live broadcast, although it was presented very much to look like a live broadcast. It was pre-recorded and edited and written. It was a drama, and it was a hoax. there is some dispute about whether it was intended as a hoax. It seems like the creators of it may have really intended it as a hoax to try to fool some people for a little while. Of course, afterwards, they had said it really wasn't intended to fool anyone. It was more of a drama. So there is a lot of gray area there and some confusion over how it was really intended. But I think we can really consider this a hoax broadcast.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that in our next episode, certainly when we get to the reaction to the show and some of the reasons why perhaps the creators maybe went back on some of their earlier statements about the true intentions behind this show. But interesting stuff to get to. And of course, as it's going to be a drama about a ghost hunt, we will actually eventually get the ghost. And so as the program progresses, not only do we find more about the history of the house and the ghost, but the fictional ghost will make several fleeting appearances on screen. With some clever tricks, really. They use some of the sort of tropes of live broadcast and, of course, there's some camera trickery. And things in the house and, in fact, in the studio itself start to get rather dark and creepy. And that earlier comic tone that Craig Charles gave us, things take a darker turn, Brian.
Yes, things do take a very dark turn, and it becomes quite intense, and there are good reasons why it's considered one of the scariest broadcasts. So we should get into some production notes here. We can start with the writer, Stephen Vogt, who had done a couple of horror films previously, Ken Russell's Gothic and William Friedkin's The Guardian. And his agent had suggested to Volk that he pitch a 6-part supernatural series in sort of the tone of The Edge of Darkness, but, you know, in a more supernatural sort of way. And it was suggested by producer Ruth Baumgarten that he should try a 90-minute Screen One drama instead.
And his original idea, we know, for this 6-part series had ended with the final episode being a live television broadcast from the fictional haunted house that he would be writing about. So instead, he sort of basically narrowed his idea down to just that, to just do a standalone about a live broadcast or an allegedly live broadcast from a supposedly haunted house, which would become, you know, obvious that it was in fact haunted as the show went on. And he also wanted to bring in some elements of that thing about science, using science to investigate supposedly haunted houses, possibly similar to stuff that we talked about when we discussed the Nigel Neal drama, The Stone Tape, which has a scientific team investigating some strange goings on.
Yes, there are definitely some elements that are in common with The Stone Tape here, for sure. The producers also discussed the impact of shows like Quatermass and the Pit, which had this huge impact in the UK in the late 50s. And Orson Welles' famous War of the Worlds broadcast in 1938, which was a broadcast that had the effect of being a hoax that many people believed was real at the time. And they based Ghost Watch to some extent on a supposedly real haunting called the Enfield Poltergeist. So there were some influences there. And of course, the title was inspired by popular programs at the time that were things like Crime Watch and Hospital Watch, Nature Watch, Spring Watch. There were lots of these watches around. So Ghost Watch seemed to fit in quite naturally with things that were out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, those programs were all over our screens at the time. These sort of sending a camera crew to look at something real like Hospital Watch. So, yeah, we were quite used to them. And then along came Ghost Watch. And you've mentioned producer Ruth Baumgarten. She handed it over to Leslie Manning to direct this show. So Leslie Manning had to deal with the sort of complexities of making it look like a live television broadcast. Although, as you've already said, Brian, all of this was pre-recorded. And, of course, she had the task of finding a cast who would fill the roles of the TV presenters. And I guess, you know, in one of the remarkable successes of this programme, she managed to get the big names on British television at the time.
Yeah, they were sort of just the right names. You know, getting Michael Parkinson was a huge coup, and Sarah Green and Mike Smith, the married couple, as we mentioned before, they were sort of big names and, like, you know, nation's sweetheart kind of thing. And they were sort of the right names that might be involved in a real live investigation that was done as a very big show. So they were sort of very, very good choices, and you know, they were big names that went in with this. They found a house in Norholt and worked with that to create this haunted house.
That's right, a very ordinary looking house, and they took a film crew there for 3 weeks. We know that was in July 1992. So they're filming there, but they're also filming in studio and combining all the effects to put this together for the final broadcast. In studio, we've got Michael Parkinson. Behind him, we've got this big wall of TV screens, which sort of produces large images on the back behind him and shows us what's happening in the house with Sarah Green. And at the time, that would have been quite new. I mean, it's a very familiar image now, but it I suppose it was quite dramatic at the time. And one other interesting little snippet, we mentioned the director, Leslie Manning. When the ghost makes its presence known, apparently the voice of the ghost was provided by Leslie Manning herself. So the director gave herself a small role.
Yes, that's right, of course. They didn't have any incidental music in this, wanting to get the feel of a live broadcast. But they did have the composer Michael Appleby involved doing sound effects work with sort of increasingly strange noises that start being sounds that might be a little bit ordinary but just seem a little odd and become very strange as things go on through the show. And you have things like the sound of cats that may have been somehow disfigured by the ghost, and, you know, you have all sorts of strange things going on in there. And certainly that sort of soundscape was something that added a lot to it. It was broadcast at 9:25 p.m. for 90 minutes on Halloween night of 1992. Something that was interesting, quite late in the process, in the last several days, I believe, the BBC decided that they would not make it as convincing as possible as a hoax. They would try to show that, yes, this was a drama. And they did that in a few ways. They did put a writer credit at the beginning of the broadcast, so it did say written by at the start of it. And they also, in the preceding few days, they had some trailers for it. So there were preview clips that were broadcast a couple of days earlier, which sort of gives you some evidence that it's not a live broadcast if you see clips of it before the fact.
So it's interesting. The BBC obviously had got wind of this idea that it could deceive people. And perhaps starting to get some intimation of the reaction it might provoke. They did try to get across the idea that this was a drama. And in fact, in the Radio Times TV listings magazine, it was, of course, listed as a drama with a written by credit and starring Michael Parkinson, Sarah Green, Mike Smith and Craig Charles and so on. But as we'll talk about in our next episode, Brian, that all those measures not necessarily successful.
That's right. They also had a Screen One logo at the beginning, and Screen One was a series for dramas. So they sort of did that gave you a clue. But all these different things that they did were fairly easy to miss. It was relatively easy to not notice the writer's credit or to turn it on just a few minutes late and miss all of those cues.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was it did go out under the BBC One drama sort of logo and title, Scream One.
So we should talk about the availability of this if you want to check it out now.
Okay, well, here in Region 2, we've had two different DVD releases. In 2002, the BFI, British Film Institute, produced a DVD which, as well as the entire programme, also included a commentary and some director notes, and I think Stephen Volk's original sort of script treatment or original ideas for the script. Like a lot of BFI releases, that didn't stay in print for very long, and it is slightly expensive. It's about £25 on Amazon when I last looked. But fortunately, in 2011, there was a very plain Region Zero DVD release, which is just the Ghostwatch programme, none of those extras, but that's rather easier to get hold of. At the moment, that's £8.60 on Amazon. And I believe that is the copy that you can also rent on Love Film, one of the main rental sites over here in the UK. So slightly easier to get hold of in Region 2. Out there in Region 1, Brian?
Well, out here in North America, there has not been an actual release. But of course, as you mentioned, that more recent UK release was a Region 0 release. And I believe it is in the European PAL-style resolution. So there are still some DVD players kicking around that won't play that European format. But I think most will at this point. And certainly computers that play DVDs generally would be able to play it. And there's no region lock on it. So the Region 0 version from the UK is quite usable in general. And you can import that from the UK, of course. And it's also available on Amazon.com for about $25 right now.
Okay. You can at the moment, if you search for it, you will find the video is up on various video websites. As ever, the quality is not great and they tend to be taken down. And if you can get hold of one of the DVDs, we'd always recommend that here on British Invaders. So not too hard to get hold of, we think, Brian.
Yeah, that's right. It's reasonably easy to grab a copy if you want to look at this guy. So next time, we will get into the story of 41 Fox Hill Drive, this house, and the menacing presence of Mr. Pipes.
Yes, and of course, as we've promised, we're going to talk about the reaction to this program, and it was considerable, and why it's had such a lasting impact, and perhaps why it's never been repeated on British TV.
Yes, there is certainly a lot to talk about with that. And we will also, of course, get into our own reviews and recommendations and what we thought about this.
Plus, we may have some feedback from the Facebook group. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Lots to talk about next time. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at BritishInvaders.com. We are part of the Geek Culture Network, so you can find us at TheGeekCultureNetwork.com. And we have a Facebook group with plenty of activity there, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find us that way too.
And you can also find us on VogNetwork.com. That's the Voice of Geeks streaming radio, proud members of their network. Our shows go out there on a Monday and a Tuesday evening. And as ever, if you've joined us from Vogue Network, welcome aboard.
Yes, they have lots of neat stuff happening there with the streaming audio feed and links to all sorts of podcast episodes from different podcasts. And they have reviews you can read of various things and lots of things going on there. So some neat stuff there for sure. So thank you for listening. And this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. Until next time and more ghostly goings on, this is Eamon in England also signing off.